This is Abel in Beijing, China. Welcome to my podcast, The Tale of Rome, Episode 13, State of the Union, 509 BC. This is our first episode of the State of the Union, and just as many things that happened in Rome for the first time, this episode will have the honor and the duty to establish norms, styles, and other precedents for future editions of episodes of the State of the Union. If you heard our last episode, you'll know that this week's episode will be a little longer and we won't have our Word of the Week segment. So let's start right now, because we don't have all day and we have an eagle's flight of many miles in circumference. Our eagle's flight is going to start in Rome itself. We'll see what's going on in Rome, Etruria, and Gratia Magna, which is the southern part of Italy. From there, we'll see the three large islands near Italy, Sicily, Corsica, and Sardinia. Then we'll go to the north, and once we hit the Alps, we will give a gigantic clockwise turn that will take us through all the parts that sooner or later will have an influence in the history of Rome. We'll see Dalmatia, Macedonia, Epirus, and Greece. From there, we'll head over to Asia Minor, and then to the lands of Syria, Palestine, and Egypt, which at that time were under the yoke of the Persians. Then our flight will take a sharp turn towards the sunset, towards Carthage and the northern coast of Africa, and then we will fly over the columns of the Gibraltar, which, depending on whom you've read, were either opened or closed by Hercules himself. This will take us back to Europe, where we shall see the peoples who inhabited what is now Spain and Portugal and the Gauls. We will make a small detour to mention the British Isles, and from there we will return to Rome, flying over the villages of the Netherlands and Germany. Finally, two small penalty shots just for kicks, India and China. What do you think? Alright, now Rome. In the year 509 BC, the dominion of Rome went from the Apennines in the east to the Mediterranean Sea in the west. It went from the Tiber River in the north to the city of Capua in the vicinity of what today would be Naples. Back then, the neighbors of Rome were the Samnites. Of them, we'll hear a lot later. Around the beginning of the Republic, Rome had about 130,000 people in total. But here is the question. Were the Romans an anthill of people who went to work and back home to the unison of the interest of the city, like a meek, mindless mass without their own free will? Nope, quite on the contrary. The Rome of those times already had a cosmopolitan tone, and if you walked along the streets of Rome, it was difficult to distinguish who was a Roman and who was an Etruscan or a Greek settled in Rome. The city was a melting pot of different colors and creeds, smells and sounds. The streets of Rome were full of men and women, elders and children, slaves and nobles, gladiators and soldiers, teachers and beggars, and everyone only cared about his own well-being and only fought for control or for the freedom of control exercised by others. Rome had merchants and laborers, people of high education and people who did not know how to read, prostitutes and vestal virgins, debt collectors and people who owed money, people who woke up with the sun and people who went to sleep at that time. The two different social classes of Rome never agreed on anything, and while the new republic appeared as the solution to all the problems of Rome, for the people of the lower classes, the difference between having a king or having a consul was equal to zero. Rome will soon be embroiled in riots and strikes and internal struggles between those who had the power and those who did not and considered they deserved it. Thousands of plebeians, especially those who got rich as generations went by, wept in public squares and at the forums, demanding justice and the right to vote or a vote more according to the numerical realities of Rome. But those same plebeians would have completely rebelled if the government decided to give those same rights to women or to slaves or to immigrants. This last layer of society, present but ignored, had no voice or vote but held the future of Rome. Imagine the poor whites of the US in the times before Abraham Lincoln and what they would have done if the government of the US had given more rights to women, slaves, and immigrants. And note that the so-called Roman democracy was not so much an act of restrictions like today's democracies, where it is possible to challenge a president or to throw out a prime minister out of his office. No, this was not a question of limiting the power that a consul had. The powers of a consul did not differ much from the power that kings had before. The difference was that after a year, the consul had to return that power. Period. As simple as that. The other characteristic of Rome was that whenever threats showed up on the horizon, all the differences between patricians and plebeians vanished and the whole world joined in to defend Rome. The rich, because they owned the lands. The poor, because anywhere else they would be in chains for losing the battle, or worse yet. But as soon as that threat would disappear, the two parties resumed with their fights in the same place where they had stopped the fighting right before going to defend Rome. We will see much more of the two social classes of Rome very soon, but it should be said that the vast majority of Romans, and when I say a vast majority, I'm saying more than 90% of the population, they did not wear expensive robes, they did not go to the theater, and they did not eat from ceramic dishes made in Greece. Rome changed a lot in the 250 years of its existence. From a village of pastors and thieves who had neither books nor commerce, they turned into a village of farmers and landowners who had books, commerce, and an extremely disciplined army. To give you a perspective of time, I want to tell you this before we take our eagle's flight. The Romans of that time knew perfectly of the legends of Aeneas and his arrival in Italy and all of the tales about Alba Longa and all that. But that was something that happened centuries ago. In a podcast, this is heard as a story, but there is a big abyss. An abyss of 7 centuries between Aeneas and the Republic of today. And just like we think we really live in modern times with all our gadgets and all our technology, the Romans thought the same. They lived in modern times. The Romans speaking of Alba Longa is like we talking about the Mayflower and settlers coming to America after crossing the Atlantic Ocean in a really dangerous voyage. Well, time passed and the world changed. And now, let's see exactly how that world changed. Etruria. About the land of the Etruscans, we will hear much more in the near future. So here, I only want to highlight 2 things that come to mind when we talk about the relations between Rome and Etruria. While there were official routes and shipments between Etruscan cities and Roman cities, the relationship was always a relationship comparable to the Cold War of our last century. A huge percentage of the Roman population was of Etruscan origin, and their cultures and peoples were so similar that it was difficult to distinguish between the two. Their tongues did not sound alike, and that did mark a clear line in the sand. The Latin language was still in its time of development, syntactically speaking, but still, the Etruscans spoke it with a very heavy accent, while the vast majority of Romans did not speak any Etruscan at all, unless there were merchants who went back and forth between the two regions, and unless they were members of bilingual families. You can imagine this like something between Germany and the USA today. 99% of Germans and Austrians today speak English quite perfectly, but they are recognized in less than a minute or so as soon as they open their mouth. The most obvious example would be the once governor of California, Arnold Schwarzenegger, who, having grown up in Austria, still maintains such a heavy accent that the term Arnold's accent was coined in some parts of the US. But while the Germans speak English with Arnold's accent, less than 5% of Americans speak perfect German, I mean fluently. Yeah, there is some, but they are a true minority. Also, between the Etruscans and the Romans, there were no daily animosities or widespread hatred. History just dealt a few really hard blows to Etruria, and Etruria and the Etruscans ended up disappearing a couple of centuries later. Rome's fault? Yes, to a large extent, but not all. There was no plan of genocide here, or a Lebensraum-style movement which was to give territories to the Romans or to erase the DNA of the Etruscans. The Romans had committed genocides in the course of their history, such as Julius Caesar in Gaul and Marcus Aurelius in the border areas of Germania, but that was not the case with the Etruscans. Nor was there an event like September 11, 2001, which would mark the two people as enemies forever. Nope, no such thing. The disappearance of the Etruscans was rather gradual, almost like an assimilation. The Romans assimilated thousands of things from the life of the Etruscans, and one day the Etruscans woke up and realized that they could no longer be called Etruscans because they had morphed into something else. Now, let's go to Graecia Magna. To the south of Italy, the Greeks created many colonies and cities, large and small. Some prospered and others were stuck in time without advancing. Some of them became major malls and others transformed into warrior towns. And we can name many cities today that emerged during these eras of Greek colonization throughout the Mediterranean. One of the most popular cities today is Taranto, in the very south of the Italian boot, and one of the strongest was on the island of Sicily. It was a city called Syracuse. We're going back to Syracuse in a minute. Of course, this whole colonization process began about a century before Romulus and Remus, so today, I say, at the time of the founding of the Republic, these cities were already well-established trade centers with centuries of history. I put a map on the website so you can see which of the cities of Graecia Magna came from Greeks of Doric, Ionic, and Corinthian origins. Maintaining commercial relations with these cities was critical for Rome and its neighbors. So much so that in that same year, 509 BC, a treaty was signed between Carthage and Rome saying that both sides would respect the trade spheres of the other. I'm going to talk a little bit more about this when we get to Carthage. And you know what? Here, in the commercial spheres between city-states, arises the origin of the word emporium. That's right, the word emporium, which today represents a large warehouse, the style of a shopping mall or a huge supermarket, was invented at that time and in that region of the world. In fact, an emporium, as the Greeks and Latins used to call it, was a colony or city that was offered only to commercial service with one client. In other words, you had to make a treaty to get an emporium, and that assured both sides that there would be no competition in the future. Having trade agreements with many emporiums was synonymous with a bright economic future. Sicily, and coming back to Syracuse. Syracuse was ruled at that time by a young man named Gelon, G-E-L-O-N, who entered the personal guard of a tyrant named Hippocrates. Gelon helped this Hippocrates to seize power, and he himself was promoted to commander of the cavalry of a city called Gela. With the death of the tyrant in the year 491 BC, Gelon defended the children of the dead tyrant, two guys called Euclid and Cleander, against the oligarchic factions. That same year, Gelon personally assumed power, maintaining all the possessions of Hippocrates. Being allied with another tyrant named Theron, whose daughter Dimer he married, Gelon began a fight against the Carthaginians, preventing them from taking the rest of the island of Sicily. In the year 485 BC, Gelon entrusted the government of Gela to his brother. He, on the other hand, moved his headquarters to Syracuse, a city that expanded and prospered under his command to become the largest of all the Greek world. In about 20 years, Syracuse will have about 200,000 inhabitants. Corsica and Sardinia. As for those two islands, we will see them in further detail when we arrive to Carthage, because both islands were conquered and commercially exploited by Carthage and the Etruscans at that time. This happened after a battle between the Greeks and a coalition of Etruscans and Carthaginians on the western coast of Corsica. The Battle of Alalia was caused by the Greek push towards the western areas of the Mediterranean Sea, because the Greeks were being pushed in turn by the growth of the Persian Empire in the area of Lydia in Asia Minor. The Greeks, looking for a trade route between Massilia in France and the British Isles, were seen as a threat to the interest of Carthage and the Etruscans. In the year 537 BC, the battle, although technically won by the Greeks, produced so much economic bleeding to the Greek colony that Massilia effectively remained isolated from its motherland. This caused the beginning of the Carthaginian dominion over the western part of the Mediterranean. Now, let's go to the north of Italy. This time, we'll put Raetia, Noricum, and all of northern Italy, including the future Cisalpine provinces, in one single bag for the sake of time. So, further north, to the north of the Etruscans, lived the so-called Celtic tribes. The Celts were a branch of the vast Indo-European region and included tribes that were scattered from Ireland in the west, Spain in the south, and Galatia in what is now Turkey. The name was given to them by the Greek historian named Hecateus of Miletus, who considered them a group of tribes that lived in the Iron Age and that, although they showed high levels of culture, they were never united under one flag or one king and very often fought in wars and rivalries between themselves. The Celts, who lived in northern Italy in the Alpine zone of this country, were immediate neighbors of the Etruscans and they were very different from these. One of the most famous points of the Celts are the famous Druids, who were members of the priests class of the Celts. Centuries later, Julius Caesar described them in his famous book of the Gallic Wars. The Celts did not live in cities, and their villages were never united into states per se. Some of the peoples we hear today, such as the Arverns, the Belgians, and the Venetos, came from the Celts. The Celts had commercial relations with the Romans from very early on, and one of their most outstanding products was amber, a semi-precious stone that was actually fossilized vegetable resin. Amber was priceless in Rome, and it was transported to Rome from as far as the Baltic shores in northern Europe. Dalmatia, Pannonia, and Moesia. Beyond the Celtic tribes, and on the opposite side of the Adriatic Sea lived the Illyrians. The Illyrians absorbed the cultural processes that took place between the Balkan Peninsula and the Danube River. During the Bronze and Iron Ages, they spread from the north of what today is Albania to the shores of the Baltic Sea and from today's Switzerland to what today is Poland. Boats were coming and going between Illyria and Rome, and the most common products were salt, marble, animal skins from the Danube region, and later gold of what centuries later would become the Roman province called Dacia. Another not so well-known product was snake venom that served as an antidote and was used in Rome as a medicine. It was mixed with barks of certain trees to induce abortions. At the time of the beginning of the Republic of Rome, the Illyrians exerted piracy in the Adriatic Sea. That problem would be solved later and Dalmatia will become a Roman province relatively early, but for now there was no king or ruler who would unite all the peoples of that region. Behind the Illyrians and closer to the river Danube were the towns of the future provinces of Pannonia and Moesia, which then would be divided in turn into Upper and Lower Pannonia and Upper and Lower Moesia, respectively. As Romans, we need centuries to occupy all those provinces and thousands of soldiers. For now, Rome did not even pay attention to that part of Europe because it was well known that Dalmatia, with its rugged terrain and all its islands splashing the Adriatic Sea, was like an impassable iron gate and safe enough for Rome to ignore it. For now. Macedon and Epirus. Let's see Epirus first. Known as Albania today, Epirus was very different from its two largest neighbors, Greece to the south and Illyria to the north. Epirus was, and still is, sheer mountains. The Greeks themselves regarded the people of the Epirus as barbarians, who never lived in the polis, such as Athens, Corinth, Sparta, and so many other cities. And with the Illyrians in the north, there were always hostilities, which were mostly due to natural resources, watercourses, and land. One of the things that I want to mention about the Epirus is that in their mountains there was an oracle called the Oracle of Dodona, which in ancient times was second in fame in the whole area of the Mediterranean Sea, only being exceeded by the oracle at Delphi. There, at the foot of a mountain, the priestesses of the forest interpreted the future by the falling of the oak leaves in the wind. I should add that today the Oracle of Dodona is in Greece, but was clearly part of the culture of Epirus in those times. As for Macedonia, well, Macedonia is about to emerge, but it must first wait for the end of a time of war between the two most advanced societies of its powerful neighbor Greece, which are obviously Athens and Sparta. The king of Macedonia, a man named Amyntas I, was forced to recognize the sovereignty of King Darius I and even gave a daughter in marriage to a high-ranking Persian dignitary. According to local sources, instead of handing over one of their daughters, they sent a man with shaved legs and chest, but I'm not sure if that detail could have been true or not. We might get to that tale in the future. I think it could be fun. Anyway, the wars that will soon be unleashed between Athens and Sparta will have as a consequence, first, the fall of Athens, then the fall of Sparta, and then the birth and rise of Macedon with all the glory that Alexander the Great gave to the world. But we're not there yet, so let's go to Greece. One of the three big topics of the State of the Union is Greece. First, Greece, just like Rome, was in transition between two of its super famous eras. History marks the year 480 BC as the end of the archaic period of Greece and the beginning of the classical era. Some sources differ in about 10 years, but this is not the case. We all know that ancient Greece can be divided into four eras or big parts: the Dark Age, the Archaic Age, the Classical Age, and the Hellenistic Age. The Classical Age began almost at the same time as the founding of Rome and was marked with the first Olympic Games in the year 776 BC. So now, in about 20 years, Greece will enter its so-called Classical Age. And why the change of age, you wonder? The reasons are several, but I want you to remember one thing. The Persians are on their way. And before I speak of the Persians, I want to give you three important names which you may have heard or perhaps not. 1. Clisthenes of Athens, the famous liberator of Athens. 2. Miltiades II, also called Miltiades the Young, a famous Athenian politician and general. And finally, 3. Hipparchus, son of a tyrant from Athens. I mention Clisthenes because it was he who helped install democracy in Athens in the year 508 BC. Personally, I think that's why the Roman historians centuries later modified the date of their own arrival of democracy, but of that I already spoke during our last episode. I name Miltiades the Young, for he was the one who defeated the Persians in the super famous Battle of Marathon, in which the messenger of the Athenians' victory against the Persians famously fell dead after uttering the words, "We beat them," because he ran all the way from where the battle took over to the city without ever stopping. Well, maybe he didn't say "we beat them," maybe he said "victory" or something like that. Today, the distance he ran is the distance for the Olympic sport called the marathon. Okay, we're not there yet. The battle is still 19 years in the future, and we might have another episode of the State of the Union before that, but I want you to remember, year 490 BC, the Battle of Marathon. And finally, I name Hipparchus because it was he who sent to collect the poems of Homer along with other ancient works of art. While he was the son of a tyrant and ruled Athens with his brother Hippias after the death of his father, Hipparchus protected many artists, including the poet Anacreon. Before I leave the subject of Greece, I want you to prepare for the coming storm, the Persians. We're going to hear them roaring through Asia Minor, Egypt, Syria, and all that part of the world for the next few decades. And also remember this name, Darius I, King of Persia, also called Darius the Great. In fact, 5 years before the Republic of Rome, Darius I submitted the region called Thrace, which is now Bulgaria, and the following year he subdued the Getae, a tribe that lived on the shores of the Black Sea, of which today would be Romania. He also conquered the island of Lemnos, an island between Greece and Turkey that, at that time, was famous for having a maze so difficult to walk through that people died inside, unable to find their way out. That island was reconquered for Athens in the year 510 BC by our already known general Miltiades the Young. It seems that the symbolic value of the island of Lemnos was greater than the commercial value itself, because the island is truly small. It had less than 450 square kilometers of rocks and more rocks. Another thing that started at that same time in Greece, not only in Athens, was the printing of coins with images from both sides. And on a side note, while King Darius I was advancing towards Europe, Xerxes was just born in that same year. He would be another of the big names we'll hear from Persia in a not too distant future. So buckle up. Lastly, before leaving Greece, I want you to know that right next to Mount Olympus in the year 508 BC, the 60th Olympic Games were held. Now, and finally, let's go to Asia Minor. The name Asia Minor was first used by the Christian writer named Orosius in the 4th century AD. Orosius used that name in his works called The Seven Books Against Paganism, and in his books Asia Minor includes the following territories: Thrace, north of the Strait of the Sea of Marmara, which separates Europe from Asia, and Mysia, south of the same strait. Let's grapple along the west coast. We have Bithynia, Paphlagonia, and Pontus along the southern coast of the Black Sea. Phrygia and Galatia in the center, and Cappadocia in the east. And finally, Lycia, Pamphylia, and Cilicia along the south coast. It is also necessary to include the islands of Crete, Rhodes, and Cyprus. Of course, I am not going to do a recount of what was going on in each of these kingdoms, first because Rome is still a few centuries away from conquering them, and second because at this time only one nation mattered throughout Asia Minor, Persia. The entire region was conquered by the Persian Empire between the 6th and the 5th centuries BC, and then by Alexander the Great in the year 334 BC. 4 years before the birth of the Republic of Rome, Thrace fell to the power of Darius I. Syria and Palestine. Syria was Phoenicia. Probably no other country has had as many changes of fortune as Syria, and this is something that unfortunately has not changed even today. Its geographical location made Syria always a magnet, a treasure to have and to behold, and Egyptians, Sumerians, Assyrians, Babylonians, and Hittites successively occupied the strategic soil of Syria during its history. Syria was always a land of passage among the empires of the world. During the conquests of Darius I, Syria was one of the first lands to fall, and it was under the power of the Persians until the conquests of Alexander the Great. As for Israel, or the land of Canaan, we can say this. The military actions of King Darius I of Persia and the campaigns in the Middle East allowed the Jews to leave their captivity in Babylon and return to their homeland. During the 6th year of the reign of Darius I, the Israelites began to build a new temple according to the book of the prophet Ezra. On the 25th of February of the year 515 BC, that second temple of Jerusalem was finished. This temple replaced the first temple, which was also called the Temple of Solomon, which had been destroyed by the Babylonians back in the year 586 BC. This temple would stand until the year 70 after Christ, when the Roman legions razed it to the ground. I can't wait to get there in our podcast. Egypt. In those times, the splendor and grandeur of Egypt was a shadow of the past. In fact, the occupation of the island of Cyprus proved to be the high watermark of the Egyptian success under the 26th dynasty. In 545 BC, the Persian Empire took that island back from the Egyptians. The Persians continued to conquer the Babylonian Empire, and in 526 BC, they invaded Egypt. In the Battle of Pelusium, the Egyptian army was defeated and Egypt joined the huge Persian Empire, becoming a mere province of Darius I. This event marked the effective end of ancient Egypt's history as the home of an autonomous civilization. Henceforth, its story was, as a member of a wider world, its fate largely determined by foreign players. Persia. Without a doubt, the Persia of the times of Darius and Xerxes was the superpower of the time. I will not waste a lot of time describing Persia and its growth because I want to devote more time to all the regions subjugated by the Persians, and also because, well, we will see much more of the Persians in the next State of the Union episode. Besides, I have already been listing regions as they were falling under the Persians as if it were a game of dominoes. Why go back to talk about Persia again? The only thing I do want to do is emphasize that if the Persian invasion had not stopped in Greece in the next generation, today the world would be very, very different. Instead of using columns in front of bank buildings, maybe we would be using ziggurat facades, perhaps shaped like towers or pyramids instead. Instead of using the Latin alphabet, the world would be using some deviation of the cuneiform script. Monotheism, the belief in one single God, would not have had the opportunity to grow, and even the most primordial institutions, such as family, marriage, and succession of inheritance, would be very different. The defeat that the Persians suffered saved the Western world and caused the beginning of the end of the greatness of Persia. It is not for nothing that today in Iran, when a mom wants to scare her child to go to sleep fast, she tells the child that if you do not get asleep quickly, Alexander the Terrible is going to come and he will eat you up. That's right. In Iran, instead of the great, Alexander is the terrible. Carthage. This is another superpower that could have changed the world at the time and did not. Who didn't hear about the elephants crossing the Alps? The consequences of what may have been are immense. And here, we can also say that the world would be very different today if things didn't go the way they did. About Carthage, we will hear a lot more than trumpets and the sound of rabid elephants. And this is the nation that has a face-off with Rome written on its forehead. And if you remember Queen Dido and what I told you in episode 1, quite rightly so. For now, it is sufficient to know that Carthage owned 3 regions that will soon be rubbing the noses of the Romans, shouting for piety: Sicily, the eastern coast of Spain, and Carthage itself. Honestly, I can't wait to get to that part of the story in my podcast either, and I so want to tell you about the things that happened in that Super Bowl between Rome and Carthage. And yeah, like all good matches, there wasn't one game. There were 3. 3 wars, 3 different results, and 3 chances to change the world. Anyway, let's keep flying west. About the rest of Northern Africa. Phoenician traders arrived on the northern coast of Africa around 900 BC. In the 6th century BC, there was a Punic presence in a city called Tipasa in today's Algeria. From its main center of power in Carthage, the Carthaginians expanded and established small settlements called emporiums in Greek along the coast of Africa. These settlements eventually served as market towns as well as anchoring and refueling sites for ships. And speaking of settlements and colonies founded by the Greeks and Phoenicians, let's see Spain and Portugal. The Phoenicians were the first of the historic colonizing people of the Iberian Peninsula. And in episode 1 of this podcast, I mentioned that according to archaeological sources, Lisbon was founded around the year 1200 BC. Many settlements were founded during the first centuries of this colonization, and some examples are Malacca, which is Malaga, and Gadir, which is Cadiz. In Malaga, there are still remains of the city walls, appropriately called the Phoenician Walls of Malaga, that were discovered during repair works at Malaga's Palace of Customs. They date back to the time when Rome was founded. In parallel with the Phoenician colonization of Spain, the Greeks and then the Carthaginians themselves, they also established their cities and settlements all along the coasts of Spain and until reaching the Canary Islands and the British Isles, which had just entered the Iron Age. The Phoenician colonies soon gained control of the Mediterranean trade routes in competition with the Greek colonies, which were excluded from the Straits of Gibraltar. The Atlantic routes were monopolized by the Phoenicians, who profited from the trade of metals, especially pewter, of the British Isles and Galicia. By archaeological evidence, we also know that Spain and Portugal were the first 2 regions that felt the change in climate that affected Europe between the years 600 and 100 BC. So profound was that change that the river Tiber will freeze over completely twice, in the year 398 BC and then again in the year 396 BC. It is believed that this same climate change known as the subatlantic period caused the presence of reindeer in the forests of southern Europe, which was unthinkable 100 years before. Returning to the colonies of present-day Spain, we know that the foundation of Nueva Cartago, or New Carthage in English, which today is called Cartagena, was an initiative made during the 3rd century BC at the time of the Punic Wars against Rome. About Spain and Portugal, we will see a lot more in the future too. Gaul. And while we still have to wait some two more centuries to go into the juicy details of Spain, we will have to wait yet another century to reach the interesting parts about France, which, as everyone knows, was called Gaul at that time. Although in the south of Gaul, we already have Greek settlements, such as the port of Massilia, today's Marseille, which was founded around the year 600 BC, it will not be until the conquests of Julius Caesar that this whole thing really becomes interesting. Within 100 years, a city called Lutetia will be founded, which is now better known as Paris. The only thing that is worth mentioning at the moment is that France, just like Italy, had a soil and a climate very appropriate for the production of one of the favorite products of the Mediterranean peoples, grapes. The cultivation and processing of grapes was improved over the centuries after being initiated by the presence of Greek colonists, and its derivative product, wine, was the symbol not only for Rome and the West, but later it will become one of the symbols of Christianity as well. As another note of general culture, I want to thank two people in France who about 50 years ago decided to create a series of comic books called Asterix, where they tell the story of a village of indomitable Gauls and their resistance against the rule of Rome. My childhood was molded by Asterix and his stories, and the stories behind the stories, once I was old enough to get them. I spent hours and hours laughing at Fat Obelix, at the bard who sang badly, the chieftain of the village with his not-so-nice wife, the owner of the fish market that never had fresh fish, and so many more. I learned about history, geography, society, and much more in a way that only Asterix could have given me. Thank you, Mr. Uderzo, and thank you, Mr. Goscinny. May you rest in peace. And now, let's briefly go over to the British Isles. Stonehenge, a collection of Neolithic monuments erected between the years 3000 and 1500 BC, is easily the most predominant symbol of the British Isles before the invasions of the Romans. Another important information that we have from around the time of the foundation of the Republic of Rome is a navigation manual or a navigation logbook called the Massaliodi Periplus, which was probably written in the 6th century BC. The Massaliote journey, well, this means it was written by somebody from the city of Massilia or Marseille, contained a narration of the voyage by sea from today's Marseille along the western Mediterranean Sea. The logbook describes the maritime routes that go north from Cadiz in Spain, along the Atlantic Europe coast of Britain, then Ireland, and finally all of today's Great Britain. This is the first document to describe the trade links between North and South Europe, and the existence of this manual indicates the importance of such commercial links. This is mainly due to the trade of tin and other raw materials from the British Isles to the south. Germania and the Lowlands. We are already approaching the end of our circumnavigation and we are flying over the Netherlands and the region known as Germania, which was inhabited by innumerable Bronze Age towns and they all had no fixed borders among them. We know that around the year 800 BC, those tribes already knew how to produce beer, and around the beginning of our era, they definitely entered the Iron Age. As the peoples in question did not carry any kind of writing of their own, all the information comes from outside, mainly from Roman and Greek travelers and historians. Foreign influence is believed to have been risen due to the trade of amber. In both Germany and parts of Scandinavia, many petroglyphs shaped like ships, some large stone formations known as the stone ships, suggest that shipping played an important role. From all this region, we will speak more in depth once Germania begins to be a real obstacle to the expansion of Rome in some 500 years down the road. And so, we get to the end of our circumference and, as promised, let's take a brief look at what was going on in India and in China. India. In the year 516 BC, Darius I invaded and conquered the huge region of India called the Punjab. With that move, the Persian Empire effectively becomes the power with the greatest control of humans on the planet. Partly because in China, we are in the middle of a colorful period called the Spring and Autumn period. where there was not a single ruling dynasty of the mass of Chinese people. India is still a century and a half away from starting to create its own commercial connections with Rome and other parts of Europe across the Red Sea. But still, India never got beyond the Red Sea, and the goods aboard Indian ships changed hands two, sometimes three times, until they reached the cities of southern Italy and then Rome. On the other hand, Indian navigators were the first to understand and to use the monsoon winds of the Indian Ocean, during which they could take advantage of this natural force in such a way that sea voyages were doubled in speed. China. In China, during the period of spring and autumn, a king named He Lu of a kingdom called Wu established what is today Suzhou as its capital in the very same year of the foundation of the Republic of Rome. Then, in the year 473 BC, this kingdom Wu will be defeated by another kingdom named Yue. The golden age of Suzhou was at an end. Wow, what a roundabout we have made. I placed four maps on the podcast website with the occasion of this episode, and I think it will help you enjoy the timeline of this episode a bit better. The first map is a regional map of present-day Turkey, that is Asia Minor, with all the kingdoms and peoples as I read it some 10 or 12 minutes ago. The second map is a map of the advancement of Iron Age across Europe. The third map shows the division of the waters of the Mediterranean Sea between Carthage, Rome, Etruria, and Greece, so that it can give you an idea of which places were controlled by which power around the year 509 BC. And the fourth map shows the Persian Empire in relation to the rest of the known world in that same year. And I don't want to forget that I promised to tell you why every 13th episode will be called the State of the Union episode. Well, 13 is just my favorite number. Alright, let's see now. Next episode, we're back to our tale, the Tale of Rome. Episode 14, Life and Death of Junius Brutus. We will see how the Battle of the Arsian Forest ends, and we will get some good news and some bad news for the Romans. The good news? Well, Rome won. The bad news? I am pretty sure you already know that Junius Brutus was killed in that battle, so I'm not going to keep that detail as a secret. But now, I do have two questions for you. One, why did Rome mourn this guy Junius Brutus for a whole year? And two, why did Junius Brutus fall on his nose when some years ago, actually many years ago, he went to visit Greece while watching over the sons of Tarquin the Proud? Yeah, he really did fall on his nose on purpose. And he almost broke his nose, much to the laughter of the young boys, after leaving the Oracle of Delphi, where a priestess told them all about who will become the next king of Rome. Also, let's see how Junius Brutus witnesses the torture and decapitation of his own two sons, a couple of weeks before he died on the battlefield. Thank you for listening, and until next week.